Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today as we take a look at prairie plants today. Did you know that they're the rock stars of a drought-resistant landscape? At least that's what Neil DeBole says. He's president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. He's been a regular on our show for many years, and it's great to have him back today to talk about prairie plants and what to do about them. Certainly, if you have questions, you can join in with them at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And also post a comment on our Facebook page or even a photo. Maybe you've got a nice prairie photo at the Larry Mueller Show. Go there and you can post there. Neil, great to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry.
You busy?
We're very busy.
Oh.
Yeah, it's good. This is our fall season starting up here. And we got more things going on than we imagined. So there may be a recession out there, and we certainly felt that for the last couple of years. But people seem to be getting right back into investing in their landscape, and that's really heartening.
Well, you know, it's some parts of Wisconsin are considered moderately in problems in terms of rainfall, and other parts of the country, of course, like Texas, oh my goodness, really bad. And we get those stretches here in the state, and I know. When you get that hot, dry weather, native plants respond a little differently than some of our other plants.
Especially the prairie plants.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. If you look at it in a long-term sense, prairie plants are the plants of the future because if you do indeed believe in global warming, and there are those who don't, but the evidence seems pretty strong, these are the plants that will be able to tolerate the hot and potentially dry conditions that we'll be seeing more and more of. And that's for very specific reasons because they have evolved over millions of years to be able to deal with the perturbations of climate of the Midwest and the Great Plains. And so a lot of these plants are ideally adapted to conditions of really dry and hot conditions.
Many of them, the roots go way down.
Yes. Your short prairie grasses, for instance, go anywhere from 2 to 4 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the wimps.
Yeah. Okay.
The tall prairie grasses go 5, 6, 7, even 8 feet deep, and some of your flowers can have roots 15 or 20 feet deep and more.
Isn't that amazing?
It's totally amazing. And in fact, this is really interesting. Some of the prairie plants actually thrive during drought because there's no competition from other species. They've got these roots 10, 15, 20 feet deep. They've still got moisture and nutrients, and they just rock.
Right. Well, Dan in Partyville has a question for you, and I want to give him a chance. Dan, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I've been working on a prairie garden for the last 4 or 5 years now. The oldest part of my garden, I kind of let it get out of hand this year because of lawn mowing, and it was wet. And so I got a lot of quack grass and crabgrass in there. I was out there last night, and it'd be very difficult for me to get that out right now. Would I be better off to wait till spring and burn that, and then the quack and the crabgrass will be the first ones to come up, and then try to take care of it?
Actually, you have two very different situations here, Dan. The quackgrass is a cool season perennial, and the crabgrass is a warm season annual.
Okay.
And they have very different cycles and very different strategies for controlling them. For instance, let's start with the quackgrass. Because it's rhizomatous, it's an absolute exercise in futility to try and dig it out because you will almost never get all the roots, and those rhizomes can actually thread through the crowns of your prairie grasses. It's really an amazing plant. But we do have strategies, and you're absolutely right. Burning is your best strategy for controlling quackgrass by burning in mid to late spring, and by mid to late spring, we're usually looking at late April or even early May. This year, we were burning prairies all the way into mid-May because it was such a cool, wet year. But the strategy here is you let the quackgrass get about 5 to 6 inches tall. It has consumed, this is in the spring, let it grow up to 5 or 6 inches. It is now consuming the root reserves that it stored over the winter to produce the new leaves, but it has had minimal time to replenish the roots through photosynthesis and translocation of carbohydrates back down into the roots, so it's weakened. You now burn it at that time, you deprive it of its new growth, and so the money, quote-unquote, that it took out of its root bank account is wasted, and by burning, you turn the soil black. The soil warms up. Quackgrass is a cool season plant, and so it grows best under cool conditions. When the soil turns black, the soil warms up very rapidly, moving it into the range where the primarily warm season prairie flowers and grasses thrive, giving them a competitive advantage. And this is the easiest, simplest method for controlling quack. It will not kill it. It will not eliminate it, but you can render it pretty much non-competitive by this method. You can also, some people that are not adverse to using herbicides, you can carefully use grass-selective herbicides, such as Post, Fusilade, or Select, to spray it in the fall when all your prairie grasses are completely dormant, as long as the temperature is above about 60 degrees Fahrenheit. But that's very effective, but you have to be very careful that your prairie grasses are completely dormant and you use only a grass-selective herbicide.
What about the crabgrass? And how do I tell the difference?
Crabgrass is an annual. If you pull it or dig it, it has a relatively shallow root system and no rhizomes. It does creep across the surface of the soil, but those are actually superficial stems that can root into the soil, whereas the crabgrass has rhizomes underground, and they're usually about an eighth of an inch in diameter, and they're white.
Yep, that's what I have, quack. I don't have crab, then. It's quack.
Okay, that's quack. And actually, quack is a lot harder to control than crab. Crabgrass, and for those people that do have crabgrass germinates excuse me, when the soil warms up, usually around mid-May or so and into June and even July. And crabgrass is an indicator of open, exposed soil because, as an annual, it has to have exposed soil in order to germinate and grow. There's two ways to handle this. Number one is to plant your prairie plants closely enough together, usually about 1 foot on center. As they mature, they will completely consume the soil environment and the foliar environment, leaving no space or open soil for annual weeds like crabgrass and others to germinate and grow. If your plants are farther apart, then you can use mulch to mulch around the plants. It's extra work. I'm not a big fan of mulch. And you want to be very careful about the mulches you use. I prefer to use grass-based mulches like straw, clean straw, not hay. Never use hay. I learned that the first time I planted a prairie and mulched it with hay. Oh, my God, the weeds were everywhere. Big mistake. Use clean straw like winter wheat straw between the plants, about 3 to 4 inches deep. I avoid wood chips and wood-derived mulches, especially if you put them on more than a couple inches, because new studies have shown that wood mulches can interfere with the mycorrhizal fungi that help transfer nutrients in the soil to the plants. It's a brand new study that came out. So you want to be really careful. I don't really like using bark mulch on herbaceous plants. Great for trees and shrubs in moderation. Not recommended for around herbaceous plants like prairie plants.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. Good luck.
Good luck. Thank you, Dan, for calling. Adam, we turn to you next in Presque Isle. Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning. I just want to encourage your listeners to think about putting in a prairie flower instead of big grassy lawns, particularly, you know, when you have these big suburban things. My wife and I bought some land up north in Vilas County, which you wouldn't think of as a flower place, but we had part of it, the 32 acres or 5 acres of meadow that had been pasture. We had the whole thing turned over by a local farmer, and we put in a mix from Agricole, which is a Wisconsin corporation out of Monroe, and they have like 230 species of native wildflowers, and they'll mix them according to which part of the state you're in and what kind of soil. Anyway, we followed their instructions, and I know there are other places too. And after 3 years, 4 years, we have this fabulous mix of about 25 plants. I concentrated on birds and bees and butterflies for two reasons. One, because the things that attract insects are brighter and prettier. And secondly, as I understood it, the pollen and so on is bigger, and I had some allergy issues, and I didn't want the wind dispersed flowers.
Hmm. Comments, Neil?
Yeah, it's interesting that we have customers all over the state and out of state too. And a lot of people do not think of northern Wisconsin as a place where prairies would grow or did grow. But in fact, people who have dry, sandy soils in northern Wisconsin can have great results with prairie plants because your prairie plants are adapted to growing on drier, warmer sites. And if you look historically, Marinette County had extensive areas of prairie on those sandy soils. I was just up in Bayfield County for vacation a couple weeks ago in the Muckwa Barrens, which is almost, it's right outside of Bayfield.
Yeah.
And there's areas where they've managed for prairie, and it's just amazing. These are natural native prairies that have been up there for God knows how long.
Yeah.
So, and you see prairies all over the state. But you want to be careful. When you get into a more northern climate where it's cooler and usually damper, not necessarily, but where you have cooler temperatures, clay soils don't usually do very well because they stay so cool late in the season, and they do not favor the primarily warm season prairie flowers and grasses. So if you're in northern Wisconsin, you're probably going to want to focus on planting prairies on dry, well-drained, sunny sites. South-facing and west-facing slopes are particularly good because they are hotter and drier than, say, a north-facing slope or an east-facing slope.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Adam. Appreciate your call. And, well, lots of callers. Let's go to BG in Dodgeville. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Sorry, I'm on speaker. I can turn that off. I'm wondering about adding a seed to a pasture.
Do you have a particular strategy that you want to use?
Well, there are already established pastures with some brome and Kentucky Blue and that sort of thing, but there's plenty of gaps, and I've been pulling foxtail, and so would like some good drought-resistant prairie plants to go in there, but don't know what might endure horse grazing.
Okay, so we have two factors here. You have established bluegrass and bromegrass and horses grazing the area, correct?
Yep.
Okay. I will tell you, in general, if you have established perennial vegetation such as you have, if you do not eliminate that vegetation completely prior to seeding, you may as well just go take dollar bills and throw them on the ground and watch them blow away.
even though it's sparse in places, the ground shows through because it wasn't grazed and mown up until the last 2 years, so that the grasses that are there were always grown very, several feet tall, so that now that they're clipped down, there's open ground between the plants.
You could go in and scratch those areas up and put in seeds. The problem you're going to run into is that both Kentucky bluegrass and smooth brome are rhizomatous perennial grasses, and they tend to creep and crawl by rhizomes. Now, because you have some horse grazing pressure on them, that may reduce their stature and reduce their competitiveness. The other issue you have here is that the horses will likely eat some of the plants that you may plant in there. And I am not sufficiently versed in what prairie plants horses prefer, but I know they do eat many of the different flowers. So you might have a conflict there as well.
I know they love cup plant.
Yeah, they like the genus Silphium in general. Compass plant is one of their favorites, cup plant. I don't know if they eat prairie dock or rosin weed, but horses are, they can eat a lot of stuff, and of course, what they don't like, they'll leave completely alone. So there are many prairie plants that they will leave alone, but my concern here is if you do pursue the strategy, you're going to want to make sure that you do plant plants that you know are resistant to horses, and they're not one of their favorites.
And do you have a suggestion about where I can look at, who might know that?
That's a really good question. You know what I would suggest you do? Call Prairie Nursery and ask for our consulting ecologist, Jennifer Baker. She has horses, and I'm not sure if she has a lot of experience as far as what they eat in her prairie, because she probably doesn't turn them out into her prairie, but she may be able to give you some information on that. And feel free to give us a call. And if you want to, you can also call us for those people that would like to get more information. We do have a nice catalog we can send you.
Yes, we have it.
Oh, you do? Great. But if you call... great. But you can call Jennifer if you call 1-800-476-9453. Her extension is 263. I don't know if she's in today, but she'll certainly return your call as soon as possible. And, again, I can't vouch for her experience as far as whether she's put her horses out into her prairie or not, but she'll probably know where to turn, because she is an avid equestrian and, of course, an avid prairie planter.
Perfect.
All right.
I'll give her a call. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, our guest today as we talk with him about prairie plants, the rock stars of drought-resistant landscapes. Larry Mueller here. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking prairie plants with Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Larry Mueller here. Thank you for listening in. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And as a matter of fact, Joe from the town of Grant in Portage County wanted to share this great video of the prairie burn that the fire crew at UW Stevens Point did for him last fall. And so if you go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, you can see that burn in progress. And then Suzanne Dyer sent some landscape photos, beautiful plants around their home, aren't they, Neil?
It looks great.
Yeah, it looks absolutely beautiful. Just to go along with that, we had an email from Carol, she says, we have an area which once contained an above-ground pool has a deck surrounding it, but the pool was taken out before we moved here, which was 6 years ago. Soil basically sand, Wisconsin Rapids area. Wondering what kind of prairie plants we can put in, which would be pleasant to see from the deck and would require little care. There are only a few weeds growing out there now. The area gets about 8 to 12 hours of full sun. And she maybe wants it to look like Suzanne's.
It's not going to look like Suzanne's because Suzanne's is apparently on a more heavier soil, probably a loam, based on the plants that I'm seeing in there.
Okay.
She's got purple cone flowers and prairie blazing stars and wild quinine. These plants don't typically grow on a really dry sand, but there are a wide variety of wonderful prairie flowers and grasses that do grow in sand. And this is a great opportunity and something that a misconception that sometimes people are under, that they can't grow anything in that sand. So the first thing they do is they bring in expensive topsoil, which actually can complicate the matter, because especially when you put 3, 4, 5, 6 inches of loamy soil over sand, now what do you have? You have what we call a schizophrenic soil.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm a loam, I'm a sand, I'm dry, I'm moist, I don't know what I am. Okay, so actually in a situation like that, the best thing for you to do is to work with the existing soil that you have and select the plants that will grow in those specific conditions. And there, again, is a wide variety of wonderful prairie flowers and grasses that grow in sandy soil. We have mixes in our catalog and our website that are specific for different soil types, for dry sand and gravelly soils, for more medium loam, silt loam, clay loam, and then plants for moist areas, rain gardens, etc. So you want to be very careful that you select the right mixes or the right individual plants to match your soil and sun conditions. So, but what she can do here is select a mix that's going to meet her desires as far as height, because there are prairie plants that will grow in dry sand that will stay low. We have a low-growing mix that only gets 2-3 feet tall. We have a short prairie mix that has plants 2 to 5 feet tall. And then we have tall prairie for dry soils that will get up to 8 feet tall. So it depends on the look that you want to create. And, of course, we have specific mixes for butterflies, et cetera, that are loaded with flowers that are particularly good as a nectar source for butterflies. So you kind of want to make sure that you know what your primary goals are for that. And then by selecting the mixes for the specific soil types that you have, you can tailor it to the landscape look and function that you want it to serve.
Jane in Superior, on to you now. Hi, Jane. Thank you for calling.
Hello, and I really enjoy when Neil's on the program. I just wanted to mention that just coincidentally yesterday I was out at the Blewin Nature Center in Afton, Minnesota, and they managed their prairie restoration with bison, and I'd never seen that done. But with the woman that called about the horses, I know there's ways to integrate animals into your prairie restorations. As Neil said, there's some things to think about, but it's an interesting way to do it. And also another thing that I know, I work up in Douglas County, and with the soils up in the northern part in the Superior Basin are often heavy clays, but there's some parts of the Nemadji River Basin that have sand lenses that come through, so which is unusual up here. And I was out in the field yesterday, and there were just acres of purple prairie liatris blooming, just like almost like a monoculture, and it just took my breath away because we're not used to seeing that up here as much. So, and finally, I just wanted to say I get to work with the Master Gardeners up here, and Brian Huddleston will be here on August 24th next week. So I know they're all listening up here on your show. So I thought I'd just give a plug for that.
All right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Jane. Comment?
Yeah. You know, you bring up a couple of really good points. And let's go back to your liatris. There are many species of liatris that grow in Wisconsin. And the sandy soils up there, depending where you are, will support primarily rough blazing star liatris aspera. What I saw on the Mucla Barrens was Liatris ligulus stylus, which is meadow blazing star, which is a monarch butterfly favorite. So I'm not sure which one Jane saw there, but they're both just absolutely stunning this time of year, especially when they're in large patches. But to go to the bison aspect, this is really interesting. It's not for the average homeowner, obviously.
No.
Because bison need a lot of room, and they need really strong fences. So for a large area like that, it's a really good way to manage it, because one of the problems that we see with prairie restorations is that they're missing a very important element, and that is the grazers, the megafauna, as I say, primarily bison. And there, of course, were some elk on our prairies in Wisconsin, too, prior to settlement. And bison and elk are primarily grass eaters. And this is very interesting. You read the early accounts of the prairies in Wisconsin, and these early explorers talk about these phenomenal flower fields.
Yeah.
And then 100 years later, the people that are studying the remnant prairies in Wisconsin say, oh, they're, you know, all prairies are 80% grass and 20% forbs, and that's all how it will ever be forever after. When, in fact, if you compare that to the early accounts of the prairies, it's not consistent with it. Well, why is that? Well, maybe after 100 years of no grazing by bison and elk, which, again, are primarily grass eaters and they don't eat many flowers, you have a shifting of the balance of that ecosystem towards more grass-heavy component. So you're without that element, and this is what we see in prairie restorations. You have to be really careful when you design seed mixes, is that you don't put too much grass in because it will take over. So that's one of the things we do with our mixes. We make sure they have plenty of flowers. And a lot of people say, well, these aren't representative of the 80% grasses and 20% forbs in the prairie. Well, maybe that's really...
Guess what?
Yeah. I mean, every prairie you go to is different. So it's not like you have to have this sanctioned type prairie based upon somebody's perception of what a prairie is. You can be imaginative and creative and put basically whatever you want in there as long as you have sufficient grasses in there to support the flowers, and the dense fibrous roots of the grasses also help to squeeze out the weeds. So it's really hard to have a prairie with just flowers because it won't function very well, but you don't have to load it up on grasses. And frankly, most people want to see lots of nice flowers, and those are the things that attract your insects, butterflies, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. Dan in New Auburn has a question for you. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about the purple fringed orchid at Marius Acritis.
Purple fringe orchid?
Purple fringe orchid, yeah. I found one on my riverbank in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, West County. And I'm...
Completely lost.
Okay, well, purple fringed orchid is a great plant. And it is typically grows along stream sides, mostly. Well, we see it in central Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, and it's got to be in a very specific location, it seems. And it's an absolutely gorgeous plant. I have never tried to propagate it because orchids are notoriously difficult to propagate. But if you have an opportunity to wade through a creek, and that's probably the only way you're going to see this plant, because that's usually where you'll find it, just wading through a creek, and you will see these gorgeous purple spikes, usually mid-July into early August. But again, propagation,
And you can't really transplant those. I mean, if you move them to your lawn...
No, they require very specific conditions, and I'm not a big fan of transplanting flowers out of the wild because a lot of times you just end up killing them, and you've done more damage than good.
Kevin, in Alcadia, Iowa, we turn to you next. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a newly planted prairie just last winter. I hand-seeded 5 acres right before the first snow. I'm curious about, I've been mowing it this year, curious about when to stop mowing, and also curious about if I should burn this fall or spring, and thoughts about if burning in the fall of possibly adding seed that I might be able to collect from prairies around after it's burned.
Okay. For future reference, we have a ton of information on prairie management on our website. So if you go to www.prairienursery.com, we have a whole how-to section, and it gives you oodles of information on managing prairies, seeding prairies, preparing your site for prairies, designing prairies, etc. But to answer your specific questions, Kevin, the first year, of course, you're keeping it mowed at about 6 inches, correct?
Yeah,
okay. That's what we generally recommend. Now, as you get later into the season, there may be some of the prairie flowers and grasses that have now reached 6 inches or possibly higher if you've had good growing conditions. So generally, by about this time of year, mid to late August, we stop mowing. So that will allow the prairie plants to develop more in the next month and a half. And most of your weeds are not going to be that aggressive going into the fall. Now, next year, you typically will see issues with biennial weeds, things like burdock, sweet clover, Queen Anne's lace, etc. And what we want to do with those is we want to keep them mowed back primarily when they are in full bloom, because when you mow most biennials when they're in full bloom, you can, first of all, stop the spread of seeds because they won't form viable seeds. But many of these biennials, when mowed at 10, 12 inches, it can kill them. when they are in full bloom. If you mow them before they're in full bloom, it generally will not kill them. If you mow them after full bloom, they may be in the process of forming seeds, and even partially formed seeds can mature on the stalk if mowed and left after on the site after mowing. So you want to be very specific about your time of mowing. Generally speaking, we wait until the third growing season, the spring of the third growing season, for our first burn. There's two reasons for that. One is we usually just don't have sufficient fuel to carry a fire before a couple of years of growth. So the beginning of the third year is when we actually have enough fuel to carry a fire. And secondly, the biggest problem we have with prairies in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and the northern states is competition from cool season weeds like quackgrass, bluegrass, bromegrass, clovers, etc. By waiting until mid-spring, usually, again, late April, early May, depending on the year, to burn, you wait for these cool season unwanted plants to grow and expend those root reserves to weaken their roots, and then you burn, thus weakening those plants and providing the favorable, more favorable conditions of the warming soil for the prairie plants. Burning in the fall usually does very little. If anything, it's pretty much neutral as far as favoring your prairie plants over cool season weeds and grasses. The exception to this is on dry prairies, usually existing dry prairies, on goat prairies or sand prairies where you have lots of early spring blooming flowers like violets and pecans and passiflowers. These areas, if you burn them in April or early May, you're burning them when these beautiful wildflowers, early blooming wildflowers, are in bloom, and you're doing them no good. So generally in dry prairies, we will burn them in the fall. That's the exception.
Okay.
All right.
Hope that helps.
Great. Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, lots of callers. Charlie in Richland Center, on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, thanks, guys. I love this topic. I worked for one of your competitors for years at Applied Ecological Services. Well, the question I have is something I never did. Are there native plants appropriate for, like, septic berms and mounds?
Absolutely.
Specifically, I've got my brother's got a great big huge mound. He's tired of mowing because the grass grows like crazy. And his septic guys, you know, oh, no, you can't plant anything on there. The roots will go in and plug everything up. But I guess I'm just trying to, I guess, hear it from the expert what might be able to go in there.
We actually have a seed mix called our septic mix. Now,
oh, excellent.
This is specifically designed for septic systems, not mound systems, but septic systems with no topsoil backfill. And it's composed of dry prairie species that grow in sand and gravel backfill.
This is an actual mound up here in Lake, I think it's Vernon County, a lot of heavy clay soil. So.
Sure. In that situation, and on septic systems that have topsoil over the sand and gravel backfill in the drain field, you can use a medium soil mix designed for clay, loam, silt loam, etc., topsoil coverings over these. And you will notice also the State of Wisconsin Extension has a brochure, and it's also available online, on landscaping your mound system with native prairie plants.
Oh, wow. It looks like you've got some internet searching to do here.
Yeah, just go to UW Extension Learning Store.
And there's a whole nice booklet about how to landscape your mound with prairie plants. Now, there's a misnomer here about roots clogging septic systems. And 29 years ago, I planted a prairie over our brand new septic system at our office. And before I did this, I talked to a couple guys in the DNR who had the unenviable job of exhuming failed septic systems. And they said in over 100 excavated failed septic systems, they never once found any instances of herbaceous plants, flowers and grasses, ever clogging the pipes with roots. Trees and shrubs, absolutely a common problem.
Oh, so, sure.
But herbaceous plants, they said they never saw an instance of these types of plants clogging the pipes. So then UW Extension developed this brochure not much later after that on using this native prairie plants for landscaping mounds. You can also use it on septic drain fields.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
You bet.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Kelly in Erin, Wisconsin. We're on to you now. Hi, Kelly.
There. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because we're very concerned about a small piece of pasture that we've recently bought and we've moved to, and our plan was to let it sit fallow, which it has now for 6 or 8 years. after a neighboring farmer had rented it for over a decade and used chemicals and grew crops on it, soybeans and corn. We wanted it to sit fallow and be a natural pasture that we could graze an organic little milk cow on. And so we did. We let it sit fallow. Well, a good-meaning farmer down the way came and tattled and said that the county, who mows along the side of the freeway, the road that we live on, has been unwittingly spreading teasel, and that it has grown up from the roadside and up into the pasture, and that it's next to impossible to eradicate without heavy chemical killers. So what's your idea? What's your thought on teasel in a natural pasture situation?
Teasel is a non-native biennial.
Non-native.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you go to Italy, you'll see it growing all along the roadsides in central Italy. I don't know if that's where it's from, but it's there. And the way to prevent biennials from propagating is, again, as we mentioned earlier, is to mow them when they're in full bloom. Now, the
right.
thing about teasel...
Now?
Well, it's a little bit late. Okay. The thing about teasel is that it has a relatively nondescript flower.
Okay. Yeah.
Most of your biennials bloom around mid-June into early to mid-July. So you want to monitor the plant, and when it is in full bloom, just mow it down to the ground. Now, it may come back and rebloom. If it does, you wait for it to get into full bloom again and mow it again. What you do not want to do is let it get beyond the blooming stage into the seed formation stage, because, as I mentioned earlier, even partially formed seeds, when mowed, may have enough energy left in the stem for the plant to pump that energy into those seeds to finish them off so that they are viable. So you want to make sure it just does not have an opportunity to reproduce. Now, a lot of these seeds have fairly long dormancies in the soil. So this is not going to be a one-shot deal, especially if the teasel has had opportunities to propagate and produce seeds in past years.
Yeah.
If it has, then you have a seed bank in the soil that will continue to come back year after year. So you're going to find that this is going to be an ongoing process. But that is the way you can control it without using herbicides. Are there thousands of them, hundreds of them? How many are there?
Oh, maybe an acre and a half.
Okay, so there's thousands of plants out there?
Yes.
It's not something you can go out and dig them out individually?
Not me.
Okay, got it. Okay. Then mowing during when the plants are in full bloom, and mow them as close to the ground as you can, and that will at least stop the cycle of reproduction. But again, you're going to have to do this for many years in order to get rid of all the seeds in the
ground. And did you say that they're a biennial?
Yes, it generally acts as a biennial.
So right now, if we did cut them down, we'd be shaking seeds and planting and propagating ourselves. But then there must be a every other year growth right now that we'd be cutting. Like next year's.
Yeah,
so,
it won't.
So okay.
It has leaves at the base, and so mowing at this time, it's not going to do much to harm those because the leaves are fairly low growing.
They are, yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, good luck.
All right, thanks. All Could right, you
thank
burn
you.
Those off?
You know, I have no experience with that. Most of your biennials are not negatively affected by burning unless you're fond of burning in June.
Oh.
Which is nasty because it's you have all that green material.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in fact, a lot of research has been done on controlling sweet clover, which is a real problem in prairies. And sweet clover, which gets like 6 feet tall, it comes in both a yellow form and a white form. And it has the distinction of being one of the few non-native weeds that has seeds that are stimulated to germinate by fire.
Oh.
So here's our wonderful magic tool with prairies, spring burning, rendered useless in the face of sweet clover. And there was some really good research done in the 70s at the UW Arboretum, wherein they burned the prairies in June, which is a smoky, acrid fire, really bad. But it killed the first year plants, and it really whacked out the second year plants when they were in full bloom and pretty much took them out too. But that is not for the amateur, believe me. I have done June burns, and they are wicked, and you don't want to breathe that smoke.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We have an email from Tony. I have about 3/4 of an acre of lawn around my house, interspersed with maple, oak, and spruce trees, mainly around the perimeter, which I'd like to eliminate so I don't have to fertilize, etc., but I don't know where to begin. Do I have to eliminate the turf before planting prairie plants? How do I get rid of that much turf? Do I have to use an herbicide?
Okay, you have a number of options there, Tony. You really do have to get rid of that turf first because the turf has a dense sod. And in order for, I assume you're going to use seeds, because to put in transplants, you'd have to be independently wealthy to put in, you know, 35,000 transplants on 3/4 of an acre, 1 foot on center. However, there are many ways that you can eliminate that turf. You can use herbicides. That's the quickest, easiest. Simple Roundup will kill almost everything. If you have some difficult weeds like Canada thistle or crown vetch or bindweed, field bindweed. Okay, these are three species that are Roundup resistant, and in those cases, if you're using herbicides, you have to resort to a broadleaf herbicide mixed with the Roundup. But that's one option. Okay, the other choice is to till it up, and if you've ever tilled up sod, you know that's a tremendous job, and you better have a heavy-duty industrial rototiller. You're not going to go out there with your toy belt and go back and forth on 3/4 acres because it will just bounce off that sod. So you really need a tractor-mounted, like a 5 or 6 foot wide tiller, and put some power to it. And you're going to have to do that a number of times to kill the sod every couple of weeks or so. Both of these are effective methods. On a smaller area, you can smother it, like with cardboard,
sure,
old carpet, et cetera. 3/4 of an acre, that's a lot of cardboard and a lot of carpet. And you do have to leave it down on a bluegrass sod for 6 to 8 weeks. If you have perennial weeds in there like quackgrass, you have to leave it on for a full growing season from April through September. So these are some of your options. You can also convert it to a smother crop. You can plow it up and plant buckwheat in June. And that smothers most weeds. And this is what farmers did before they had herbicides. And they would get an actual crop in the buckwheat. And that's why everybody ate buckwheat pancakes 100 years ago, because everybody grew buckwheat instead of using Roundup. So, and then you plant winter wheat in September to serve as a cover crop over the winter. And then you plant buckwheat the next June. So it's a two-year process. But you can kill almost all weeds by this method, and it's totally organic. But you must make sure that you mow that buckwheat down when it's in full bloom, and do not allow it to make seeds, or you will have buckwheat for life. So these are your four of your major methods. Most people will use Roundup just to kill it off, but some people don't want to use herbicides, so you do have to resort to an alternative method in that case.
We have a Facebook question from Paul. I planted the 200-plant butterfly prairie last fall, which is doing great. Talk about a butterfly magnet. I have two questions. One, I would like to collect some of the seed from this. When would be a good time to start the seed for planting in the spring? The second is the crooked stem aster and New England aster. They really are bushed out, almost crowding out the other plants. Should I trim them back next year or just let it go? Thank you. P.S. We made your catalog with a picture of your trout last year. We attended last fall. What a surprise. Your tour last fall. What a surprise.
All right. I'm glad to hear you're having good results with our butterfly gardens. That's great. As far as the seed, when to start them, every seed is different. Some seeds require a pretreatment in order to break dormancy. Some do not. Most of your prairie grasses, if you harvest them in the fall and just leave them in an unheated building over the winter, this is sufficient to break dormancy in them. And you can simply seed them next spring, April, early May, and get them going. Many of the flowers, however, have more complex dormancies and require exposure to cold, moist conditions. And the reason for this, evolutionarily, is that let's say a flower seed is ripe in September and it falls on the soil in an open spot where it can germinate. Weather is warm. It's 70 degrees. It's raining. Everything's beautiful. It comes up, and in November it's 25 below. You're dead. Okay. They have built-in mechanisms that say, wait a minute, we have to go through a period of cold conditions and damp conditions before we'll germinate. And so their seeds are equipped with a dormancy that lets them know after that exposure to winter, then it's safe to germinate. So many of the species, prairie species, you can mix them with clean sawdust, put them in the fridge, mostly only 30 days. Okay, so if you want to plant them on April 1, on March 1st, you mix that seed with some clean sawdust, slightly damp, not wet and drippy, but slightly damp to give it the moisture, and label a little Ziploc bag and put it in your fridge. Bring it out 30 days later, seed it, and you'll see germination, well, depending on the species, a week to 2 weeks later, generally. Some species require 60 days of this treatment. Some require 90 days. And you have a few species like roses and many of your woodland plants like trilliums that require 2 years of, of time in the soil. They have to go through a winter, a summer, and then a winter. And then about 16 months after or 18 months after you collected them, they will germinate in that next spring. These are plants that are called double dormant. They're a little trickier. And then there are a few, like New Jersey tea, which is a prairie shrub, whose seeds are stimulated to germinate by heat. Apparently, after a fire, they say, oh boy, there's been a fire, there's going to be some open soil, I'll germinate now. So the way we treat that seed is we pour boiling water over it.
Uh-huh.
And then we plant it, or you can pour boiling water over it and then put it in the fridge for 30 days and bring it out and germinate it. That seems to work also. But it requires that heat treatment in order to stimulate the seed to break dormancy. And one more thing is some of your harder seeds, like a lot of your legumes, have hard seed coats, and then you need to scarify the seed coat. Generally, we'll just put the seed in a wooden box and take some sandpaper and just scratch the seeds lightly and then give them that 30-day or 60-day or 90-day treatment to break dormancy. So you need to know which ones, and if you have questions, we can supply it. Just get a hold of Prairie Nursery, go to our website, and shoot us an email and say, hey, I'd like you to send us your seed propagation sheet, and we will send it to you.
Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking today with Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery. You can join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. And if you want to post a question or even a photo or video, we've even had that today on the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, please do that. And while you're there, click like and we'll send you updates. But here's a photo on our Facebook page from Wendy from Wendy, and can you take a look at that maroon colored plant?
Well, it's not a prairie plant.
it's not a prairie plant.
No, it's not a prairie plant. It kind of looks like celosia, which is a garden plant. It also may be some form of an amaranth, and there are many different amaranths, some of which are planted as perennials or horticultural plants in the garden. A lot of your amaranths are annuals. Oh, there's a close-up. Let's see now.
Take a look at that.
That's probably some kind of amaranth, but I can tell you this. It's not a prairie plant.
We know that for sure.
Yeah, we know that for sure.
All right. Well, Carrie in Minnetonka, Minnesota has a question for you. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I am a huge prairie flower fan, and I love Prairie Nursery. I've ordered plants from you guys for the last several years.
Thank you.
I live over on Lake Minnetonka in Minnesota, and I have a slope going down to the lake. I started planting prairie plants mostly for soil erosion, and I'm trying to get rid of sumac and thistle and all this other nasty stuff that's taken over in there over the years. But the one thing I'm having really trouble growing is butterfly weed and red milkweed. I've ordered plants. I've planted them. They just seem to shrivel up and never come back.
Let me ask you a couple of questions.
Yeah.
What kind of soil do you have?
I would say kind of more loamy.
Kind of loamy, but not clay.
No. I actually ordered butterfly weed for clay for one area that's clay, and I've got them in there. They're struggling, too. But the area that I have had no luck is not clay at all, no.
Okay. And it's on a slope?
It's on a slope.
Okay. What direction does that slope face?
It faces... it faces sort of northwest.
Northwest. Okay. So you got pretty good sun in there, not really hot blasting sun, but pretty good sun, I take it, correct?
Pretty good sun, and then there's a little bit of some areas that are, it's quite a large slope, so there's some trees on the side, but
okay.
Yeah, pretty good sun.
Okay, butterfly weed really likes a lot of sun.
Okay,
especially on a heavier soil. On sandier soils, it will tolerate a half a day of shade, but on loamy soils or heavier soils, it really needs nearly full sun to do well. That probably may not be your problem there. If you have compacted, really heavy compacted clay underneath your soil, Because the butterfly weed is a taprooted plant, it may not be able to get its taproot down into that heavy clay. Even the butterfly weed for clay, which is a plant, exclusive plant from Prairie Nursery, that I was given some seeds from a friend of mine who rescued a plant in the Barnes Prairie in Racine County that was growing in a heavy clay situation. She took it home, dug 3 feet of the root out. You normally cannot transplant butterfly weed. She dug it up in front of the bulldozers that were bulldozing this prairie, took it home to her home in Milwaukee, and nursed it back to health for 3 years, and was kind enough to give me some seeds, which I've grown for the last 25 years. And it usually does very well on clay, because butterfly weed is usually restricted to sandy soils in our region.
Right.
But if you have really compacted clay underneath there, its roots may not be able to get down to that. So you might want to dig a few holes and see what's going on under there. Okay, the red milkweed is a little trickier. Now, that is typically more of a marsh plant or a wet prairie plant.
Oh, okay.
It may not be getting enough moisture. However, in a garden situation on a loam soil, it should do beautifully.
Okay.
Is it in a garden situation, or do you just plant them and kind of letting them fend for themselves out there?
I am working like crazy to keep everything else around these plants pulled. And I'm thinking maybe with my butterfly weed, they've just gotten overwhelmed by some of the other stuff growing around them.
That can be possible, if you have a lot of competition. Let me ask you this. Are you using any mulches?
No.
Okay, good, because some mulches can be problematic for prairie plants.
I heard you talk about that earlier with the wood mulch.
I've seen people put, especially these bark nuggets, that's like death. Okay, you want to? You may as well just go out with Roundup and spray your plants as put those bark nuggets on there, because there seems to be something in those that is toxic to the plants. So,
I have had really good luck with the Blazing Stars. My ironweed is fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
My Rattlesnake Master, what an awesome plant that is!
Isn't that great?
I love it. The Brown-Eyed Susans. I've had like huge luck with almost everything I've put out there.
Well, I'm wondering if your subsoil might be problematic for your butterfly weed, and possibly, I don't have a conclusion for your red milkweed, because if it's a good loamy soil on a northwest slope, it probably would do all right, even though it's a little drier than it would normally grow. It's pretty adaptable. So that one's kind of a mystery.
All right. Well, I'll keep at it. And I was kind of wondering if seed would be better than plants.
It depends on how long you want to wait.
Right.
Of course, plants give you pretty much instant gratification, and seeds are much trickier because they're subject to competition, and most of your perennial prairie plants take 3 to 10 years to mature from seeds. Most of them will mature in 3 to 5 years, but there are some of the slower-growing, long-lived plants that you may not see for 10 years after seeding, whereas with a transplant, you'll see them in a couple years, as far as blooming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Thanks. I found you guys on Facebook today to tune in, and wish I could be there Saturday for the garden tour, but it's just too far of a drive for me.
Okay, well, some other time.
Well, I'm going to do it one of these times.
Great. We'd love to see you.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling in. We'll talk about that garden tour.
Oh, yes. Tomorrow we have our late summer open house.
Saturday, this is.
Saturday, right, exactly. Saturday the 19th. We have our garden tour. Is it tomorrow's the 19th? No, the 20th. Yeah, tomorrow's the 20th, right? Yeah. We have our open house, and we're also having a plant sale. We have a lot of our 4-inch pots, quart pots, on sale for only $3. Not everything, but a heck of a lot of them. So it's going to be a really good bloom. Things are really blooming late this year, so we have a lot of things hanging on that normally bloom even in July, or so. Some of those things are still blooming even into late August. So we have tours of our display gardens and a great plant sale.
All right. And that's actually, if you go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, we have I think we linked you. So you're linked. So just if you're already on the Facebook page, you can link to it and see where to find Neil and Prairie Nursery.
We'd love to see you.
And we have a question from Paul. I have about an acre of prairie that I planted and worked on them for the last 15 years. This year, explosion of Queen Anne's lace. How to remove or control it without pulling it? I've worked on pulling it, but there are a lot of plants.
Oh, boy, good old Queen Anne's lace. I'll tell you a funny story, Paul. In my prairie, in my front yard, which is now 20-something years old, about 10 years ago, one plant of Queen Anne's lace showed up. Just, bird brought it in, or it blew in, or whatever. I said, oh, that's kind of pretty. How damaging can that be? I'll just let it go. dumbest thing I ever did. The next year, those things were everywhere. New seedlings, you know, because it's a biennial. So the next year, there are all these seedlings everywhere. I'm just cursing myself for letting it go. And to this day, I am still pulling that doggone plant out. And Queen Anne's Lace, like sweet clover, is one of the few biennials that can reestablish itself in an established sod of grass or prairie. It is a plant that you do not want to allow to get established because the seeds also have fairly long dormancies in the soil because I have a zero tolerance policy for that plant now, and I don't think any of them have gone to seed for the last 10 years, and I'm still pulling the darn stuff out, although it is almost gone. I still found 5 or 10 of them this year. So get it out, keep it out, and if you can't pull them, what you can do, and actually the easiest thing is to go out there when they're in bloom, after a rain, when the soil is damp, and pull them out by the roots. Don't leave the root behind because it will resprout and reflower. If you have a large area of it, you have to treat it the same as we talked about with the sweet clover. And any other biennial is to mow the whole thing down when it's in full bloom. The problem with that, of course, is you're mowing the rest of your prairie. Another way is just go out and clip them individually. Mm-hmm. Okay, or take a weed whacker and just whack as closely as you can just around that plant. If they have started to go to seed, then you must remove the cut material so that the seeds do not mature and then reinfest the area.
Oh, boy. And I suppose you could just, with our drought, just hose it down.
Hose it down? Oh, to get
instead of wait for the rain, hose it down. And
yeah, you can put the sprinkler up and get this area moist and then go pull those plants. But, yeah, it's a real bugger. You don't want that thing to get going and, unless you like Queen Anne's Lace and don't mind it being part of your prairie. But it can be really aggressive in the right or wrong situation.
Neil DeBull, our guest on Garden Talk. Neil is the president of the Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. He's been in business for a long, long time now. Great to have him with us here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at prairie plants on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Lots of callers online already at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post a photo or a question. We're glad to try and answer it. And, Neil, we've got fall planting season. What about fall? You talked a little bit about seeds and transplants earlier. What about it?
Well, there's different strategies for, let's start with prairies, for instance.
Okay.
Okay, generally speaking, we plant prairies either in the spring or in the fall. Now with the spring, and when I say spring to early summer, generally April, May, and June. By July 1st, we generally will really not want to plant too much later after that because you won't have sufficient growing season for the roots to become established before the winter, and they can be damaged with insufficient development of the roots during the cold temperatures of winter. That said, I have planted prairies into mid, even third week in July with good results, but there's a little more risk associated with that.
Okay.
And a lot of people will plant in the fall, especially on dry, sandy soils, and in some cases on heavy clay soils. The reason for planting in the fall on dry, sandy soils is that you have the seed pre-positioned for germination in the spring. And realize these fall plantings are what we call dormant seedings. Very few of the prairie species will come up in the fall, if any at all. So you plant this September, October, November, before there's really snow on the ground. And some people do a frost seeding where they actually scatter the seed on top of the snow. I'm a little hesitant to do that because if you have a large snowmelt event, and the snow melts really fast, the seed can wash away. But many people have very good results with that, with light covers of snow. And then the seed just works its way down naturally into the soil. But generally speaking, with a fall seeding, you're looking at September, October, November. And then the snow comes in on top of it, and then the seed works its way into the ground over the winter. Or you can use a mechanical seeder and plant it in the fall or spring. Or you can hand broadcast it and rake it in lightly, either, again, fall or spring. The advantage, one of the advantages of fall seeding is that you will break dormancy in many of the flower seeds naturally because they will experience the cold, damp conditions in the soil as they would in nature, and thus resulting in higher germination for many flower species the next spring. Disadvantages to fall seedings is that many of the warm season prairie grasses, like big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, switchgrass, well, not so much switchgrass, but Indian grass and side oats grama, these seeds do not germinate nearly as well the following spring when planted in the fall. So if your goal is primarily prairie grasses, you'll want to plant those in May and June when the soil is warm. fall dormant seedings are not really good for the prairie grasses, but really good for the prairie flowers. And in fact, I can take the exact same seed mix and plant it on the exact same soil, side by side, one in the fall and one the next spring. And 10 years later, those prairies will be drastically different. One will be dominated by grasses, or a nice, you know, a good mix of grasses and flowers, and the one planted in the fall will tend to have a higher flower to grass ratio in almost every case.
Very cool.
So, but for sandy soils, it can be very beneficial to plant them in fall because a lot of times there's very limited moisture in those soils, and some of the species that grow in dry soils germinate early. They're pre-positioned, ready to come up. Heavy clay soils, if you have a really wet, heavy clay, you may not be able to get in to work that soil until June. But in the fall, it's usually pretty well dried out. You can get in there, work it up, put your seed down, and the seed will come up on its own schedule the following spring, because by the time you can actually get in to work the soil, especially this year, okay, it was wet. You couldn't get in to work clay soil until sometime in June. You finally get your seed in the ground, and then everything goes dry.
Yeah.
Okay, wow, great growing conditions, huh? And when that clay goes dry, it is really hard for seedlings to grow in there, and that's why we recommend on heavy clay soils that you put about an inch and a half of clean straw mulch, like winter wheat straw mulch, over the clay to hold the moisture in. It doesn't hurt to do that on any seeding, but particularly on heavy clay soils, because once that clay dries out, those roots cannot penetrate into that hard clay. So
there we go. We have Chuck in Wild Rose up with a question for you. Hi Chuck.
Thank you very much. And it's, as always, a great show. We were at a dormant farm about 5-6 years ago, and everything that's coming up on it is just natural. We haven't planted anything there. We found some small patches of baby's breath of the prairie, or spurge,
mm-hmm.
a few years ago.
Flowering spurge. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that is now expanded, I would say, well over 20 acres.
Yeah, yeah.
So we're kind of wondering how that can be shared with other people who may be interested in getting spurge started, because obviously they're difficult to harvest, tiny, tiny little seeds, but what do you suggest for people who like to share that stuff?
Okay, there's two ways to propagate flowering spurge. One is to collect the seeds, and the other is to divide the roots. Flowering spurge is an interesting plant. It's kind of tough to start from seed. It's one of the harder ones to do from seed. And the seed oftentimes has weird dormancies, or a high proportion of it may not be viable. But you have to wait until the seed pods are completely ripe before you harvest them. Usually they'll turn red when they're ripe. And this is in full bloom right now. You probably have beautiful white fields right now, right?
Exactly.
Yep.
Yeah.
So in about another month and a half, the seed should be ripe. And then this is a plant that if you plant it in the spring directly in the soil, nothing will come up. If you plant it in the fall, you get much better germination. But it seems to have some kind of weird long-term dormancies that slow down its germination for a period of time. It's very easy to propagate from root cuttings. It's a rhizomatous plant. As you'll notice, it kind of creeps and crawls to form nice clumps, right?
Well,
if you wait until that plant is dormant and it all dies back, you can go and dig up clumps of the root and break them into about 5-6 inch long sections and transplant those, and they will come up next spring. Or if you mark the plants now with some kind of a stake or a flag or something, you can come back next spring before they come up in early to mid-April, dig them up, divide them, and transplant them. You'll usually get a little better results if you divide them in the spring. With fall divisions of that plant, sometimes they can get rot problems, and you can lose them over the winter in the soil. So for the best results, mark them now, go back in the spring in early to mid-April, dig them up, divide them into 5 or 6 inch long sections, plant that section 2 inches deep, the same depth that you found it in the soil, and it will sprout and come up next year, next spring.
Wonderful. Yeah, because we have places where it's totally choked out knapweed even.
That's truly amazing. Wow, that's great.
Thanks a lot for calling, Chuck. Appreciate it. Someone wondered about Canada goldenrod.
Oh, yes, Canada goldenrod, the bane of our existence. Interestingly, we have problems with many different weeds in prairies, and most of them are controllable with some targeted management. A couple of the problem ones are things like field bindweed, Canada thistle, crown vetch. These are all rhizomatous species that are really hard to control, and Canada goldenrod also fits that category. It's the only one of those that's a native plant, and it is a beast. And interestingly, what we see in prairies, especially taller prairies that have big blue stem switchgrass, mm-hmm. Indian grass, and taller flowers, when that prairie is about 15 to 20 years old, those prairie plants can, in many cases, choke out the Canada thistle, or the Canada thistle just reaches the end of its lifespan and it tends to disappear. Unfortunately, Canada goldenrod does not do that. It only expands more and more, and it not only travels by underground rhizomes to form big patches, but it has windborne seeds that can blow all over the place, and it is a really, really a problem. How do you control it? Burning doesn't make any difference. We've tried different mowing regimes during time of year. It doesn't seem to phase it. You can go in, and if it's a small area, you can pull it after a rain, but you have to make sure you get all the rhizomes. This is what I do at my house. It blew in from my neighbors, and I have little patches of Canada goldenrod, and I just keep pulling it and pulling. It's still not gone. I've been doing it for 10 years, okay? Mm. But I keep it from receding so it doesn't get out of control, and I'm slowly getting, you know, a leg up on it, but it's really hard to get rid of that way. Another option is to go in and use what we call the glove of death, where you put, like, Roundup herbicide, or that's usually what I use. I don't like to use broadleaf herbicides because they're different, you know, they're just more toxic. So I put herbicide gloves on both hands, and then I put an absorbent cotton glove over one hand, and I take a little, like a plant sprayer that I put my Roundup herbicide solution in, and put the sprayer on stream rather than mist, so you don't get misting all over the desirable plants, and then you stroke after you've saturated that glove, not dripping, but just saturated the cotton glove with the Roundup, then you stroke the entire length of that stalk and get it on the underside of the leaves, and that will go down into the rhizome and kill the plant. However, this is really a lot of work. Another option is to wait till the plants come up in the spring, especially if you burn your prairie. Then you get rid of all the material. This is really the way to do it. Burn the prairie, and then you'll see Canada goldenrod coming up. And when it's about 3 inches tall, you can go out with, unfortunately, with a broadleaf herbicide. And there are some lower impact broadleaf herbicides now, like Milestone. Okay, which has been granted the EPA's reduced risk category. It's still an herbicide. It's still something you really handle it with care, but it apparently has a very low toxicity to humans, mammals, fish, birds, etc. When those Canada goldenrods are about 3 inches tall, you can go out and carefully spot spray them, but you have to know what they look like. They often have a red tinge to them, but you better know exactly what it is, or you could kill the good guys too. This, after 2 or 3 years, you'll get it. And finally, one of my clients has a problem with it, and what he has done is he has mowed it twice a year, once in June and once in August, and he's on his second year, and I looked at his prairie, and this area was really infested. He said, I'm just going to mow the thing a couple times just to keep it down so it doesn't go to seed. I looked at it a couple weeks ago, and I couldn't find any Canada goldenrod. So he may be onto something here with this twice a year mowing, which makes his prairie pretty much useless for those years.
Right.
Okay, because he mows it down when there's blooms. But, and the jury is still out on this. I'm going to see if anything is coming back yet. But after his second mowing in the second year, which would be actually the fourth mowing over the two-year period in August, I saw no sign of the Canada goldenrod coming back. So this is preliminary data. I don't want to say that it really works, but there is possibly some hope here.
On to Steve in Soldiers Grove now. Hi, Steve. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Neil. Hey, I just bought a place with about four. It's an older farm. It's got about 4 acres of giant ragweed.
Oh, goody.
And it looked like a sugarcane plantation down in Louisiana.
Yeah.
12 feet tall.
It was so scary, I cut it down. I got a guy in with a 3-point mower, and I just wiped it out.
Good.
And now I've got, you know, a feel. So I'm thinking I'm going to burn this fall, maybe burn again in the spring if there's any point in that, and then plant rye. I've heard that if you plant rye over an old field of giant ragweed that you can snuff out the ragweed. Is that true?
Rye was commonly used as a crop to reduce weeds because the roots of rye, this is grain rye, okay, Secale cereale is the Latin name, S-E-C-A-L-E. It was used as a rotational crop because the roots produce some kind of chemical that is toxic to many other plants. It's what we call allelopathic. And so, yes, you can reduce the density of weeds. I won't say you'll completely eliminate it. And remember, those ragweed seeds can stay dormant for a long time in the soil.
Okay. I'm not gonna till it or plow it up at all.
Okay. Well, you're gonna have to somehow get that seed in the ground to make sure you got a crop. Okay. So it will reduce it, but I'm not gonna say it's going to eliminate it, because once that rye is gone, the chemical exudates from the roots will dissipate, and there's a good chance that giant ragweed will come back. The real way to handle this is to replace it with perennial vegetation that will outcompete it over the long term. And the reason that you have giant ragweed usually is that you have open, disturbed soil where it can grow because it's an annual. Okay, so if you replace that with perennial vegetation, whether that's a lawn grass or a prairie or whatever, something that's competitive that you can manage, then you can get rid of it over the long term. The problem with ragweed, of course, giant ragweed, is it grows big and tall and smothers everything else out, thus maintaining itself by not letting anything else grow there. So you have to replace it with something else over the long term. So I suggest you plant a prairie.
Good idea. Yeah, I mean, it was nightmarish. It was 12, 15 feet tall.
Yeah, you need to respect that plant. And, man, if you're a hay fever sufferer, you do not want to go near it. And you can actually, some people have a physical reaction, like they can actually get...
hives or something?
Yes, exactly. It can affect your skin. Something. If I get in there and expose to that stuff, it affects me. And I'm not a hay fever sufferer, but there's something in that plant. It's nasty.
So I'm thinking about burning in the fall, that'll get rid of a lot of the stalks and, you know, the junk that's left over from the cut. But then plant just prairie grass, like you say, plant prairie grass when it's warmer and prairie flowers in the fall then.
That presupposes you don't have any other weeds underneath there that need controlling.
I don't know what else could have lived in there. I walked through it, and I was just like I was in the Brazilian rainforest.
Okay. Well, make sure.
I was going to run across a family of apes or something in there.
Make sure you don't have any other weeds that need to be eliminated before you put your seed down. But if that's the case, you can just work that ground up and put your prairie grasses, and flowers in it next year. And because your management for the first 2 years of the prairie is mowing, either at 6 inches in the first year and 12 inches in the second year, that will keep any giant ragweed plants that come up, which I assure you they will come up, okay? That will keep them at bay, and so they cannot reproduce, and as the prairie matures, it should squeeze it out.
There you go.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Steve, for
calling.
Good luck, Steve. Tim in Door County, on to you now. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you all doing there?
Great, thank you for calling.
Yeah, Neil, got to stump the naturalist question over the phone. It's hard to do it with a plant, but
I love phone ID, plant ID. always a challenge.
This is going to be fun.
What do you got?
You talked about your Queen Anne's lace coming in. Well, I had this plant come in about 5-6 years ago. I thought, it's a pretty little plant one, and I let it grow, and it's continued to grow, and it comes up with a Queen Anne's lace, has a flower on it right now.
Mm-hmm.
Tap root, the base of the root gets kind of reddish.
Mm-hmm.
The leaves are opposite each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a set of 1, 2, 3, 4, 4, and then the top leaf.
Okay.
When they're younger leaf, it looks like a moose horn leaf.
At the top of the plant? The young leaves at the top of the plant?
No leaf at the top. The leaves are all at the base.
Uh-huh.
Taproot.
Oh. Okay.
I thought it was, I think it was wild parsnips.
Wild parsnip would have a yellow flower.
Exactly. That's why I said, no, that's not it. And I picked it by hand, and I haven't blistered out, so that it's not parsnips.
Okay. Tell me about your soil. Is it a slightly damp area?
Most of this is growing, no. No, it's everywhere now. It's into the garden and everywhere, in dry soils, damp soils.
And does it have a Queen Anne's lace-like flower?
Yes.
And how tall is it?
It's about 4 feet.
4 feet.
Yeah.
Boy, if it has a Queen Anne's lace-like flower, it's probably in the parsley family, carrot family.
I'm thinking,
Yeah, but you know what? I tell you what the best thing to do is if you can take some digital photos of this plant.
Yes.
Close-ups, you know, on high resolution of the flower, the whole plant and the leaves, and email it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I'll take a look at it, and that way we'll get you a more positive ID than a phone guess.
I've talked to Kathleen Harris up here, the park naturalist, and he actually gave her the plant.
Uh huh.
She couldn't come up with it. I'm thinking, wow, this is. But it's everywhere in the county. It's not just me.
Okay. And you know, the other thing is, you can just. Here's another thing. Just go out and are they in bloom now?
Yes.
Okay. Go out and get like 3 or 4 of them, put them in a big Ziploc bag, and you can mail them to me. But you probably want to start off with a picture, so it's a lot easier.
Picture sounds good too.
Okay, yeah. Make sure it's on high res so I can blow it up and look at it really closely. And then just send that to cs@prairienursery.com. That's customer service. Just put cs@prairienursery.com and that'll get to me.
All right.
Okay.
Do you remember Jeff Schmidt and Flint Ridge Herb Farm?
You bet.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
That's where we first met.
Okay. Yeah, it was a long time ago.
Thanks a lot for calling, Tim. Appreciate the call very much. All right. Well, Judy in Madison has a question for you, so let's go to Judy. Hi.
Hi. Hi there. I've got a real quick question. We were coming down from Rice Lake about a week ago, and I noticed a sumac along the road was turning bright red, and I said, oh, my gosh. I said, we're going to have an early fall. And then down the road a ways, we noticed a truck with a guy on the back, and he was spraying all the sumac.
Yep.
And I was wondering, what is that for? Because I've got people coming in October from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they'd be looking so nice, the sumac, at that time, and now they're going to be gone.
Yep. Yeah. I was just up the Rice Lake area a couple weeks ago on the way home from vacation, and I saw the same thing. I'm going, man, why are these sumacs all red? And then I saw a bunch with brown leaves and yellow leaves. Going, yeah, the highway crews have been out spraying. So this is part of their maintenance, and because our sumacs creep by rhizomes, they form large patches, and I suspect in this case what they're doing, it was probably on a steep slope that they couldn't mow, correct?
Yeah, I think it was.
That's where you'll usually see this. And they will go out with a broadleaf herbicide that won't kill the grass, but it'll kill the woody plants and other broadleafs, and they will spray selected trees. Because you'll notice they leave a lot of the trees alone. They just spray the sumac and
right,
other.
They just spray the top of the sumac. And
yeah.
Right. And it wasn't just to create early color for tourists from that are coming here in the summer. It's part of our tourist program for Wisconsin to make sure you experience the fall colors, even if you can't come in September. No, they were killing it because it creeps by rhizomes and is a management problem for them along the roadways. So.
Because it wasn't really that big, and I was wondering how come they were taking it all down because it's so beautiful in the fall, you know.
Yeah, you'll have to talk to your local highway commissioner about that and the county highway commissioner and ask him or her why they're doing that. But I'm sure it's because it will spread, and it's tough on their mowers because it's woody, so they don't want to have it in there. Some guys just like to go spray stuff too, so I don't know.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Judy. Linda in Stratford's husband spends a lot of time mowing. We're retired, lots of land and limited funds. My dream is to plant the area between house and creek in prairie instead of mowed lawn. However, I don't want to create even more work for my husband. I know there's a lot of effort in getting the prairie started, but when established, is there less work involved?
Absolutely. If you look at a prairie, it's like a front-loaded investment. You got to put your time and money up front. But once you've spent the time to get the site ready, to eliminate the weeds, to get the seed in the ground, and to manage it with mowing in the first 2 years, then your management is greatly reduced. And typically, if you can't manage it with burning, then you manage it with mowing. And if, for instance, if you're going to burn your prairie, generally we recommend burning your prairie every other year. And the reason for that is if you burn it every year, you will tend to push the balance of the ecosystem more towards the prairie grasses. This is with spring burns, which is usually the best time to burn to control cool season weeds. By burning, if you go every 3 or 4 years, then woody vegetation, which naturally invades by birds and wind and whatever, those plants can become established to the point where burning no longer kills them. But by burning every other year, we're able to maintain a really good balance between the flowers and the grasses, control cool season weeds, as well as woody invasive vegetation. If you can't burn it, then most people will just mow it every spring. Some people mow in the fall because they want to clean everything up, but I like to mow it in the spring because then I leave the prairie grasses and flowers for birds because there's still seeds out there sometimes.
Yeah, sure.
Winter cover for protecting birds and other critters. So then I will mow the prairie down usually at the same time I would burn, usually in Wisconsin late April, sometimes early May. So, but there is a lot of work up front. You got to make sure you get all the weeds killed off. Be absolutely relentless in this regard, because if you leave weeds there and you put your seed down, it's very hard to get those weeds out afterwards. So get all your perennial weeds eliminated, whether you're using herbicides or smothering or tillage or whatever. Make sure they're all dead before you put your seed down. That's the most important thing, and from there on, you'll have less work.
And just in that last 30 seconds here, your field day is tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes, at 10 a.m. and 1 p.m. we have tours of our display gardens. Things are looking really good, and we have a big sale. You can get quart pots of many of our flowers on sale for only $3, flowers and grasses. And there's all sorts of other things there, too. And this is a great time to plant because you get your plants in late August, early September. They get their roots down before winter, and they'll be raring to go next spring.
And if you would like to find out where the Prairie Nursery is located, you can go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show. We have a link directly to it. Neil, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
He'll be back. Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, and he will be back. And we'll have him again. Just to take a look ahead to Monday, We'll be taking a look at the Madison Area Community Supported Ag Coalition, and then we'll talk with the author of Indomitable Pluck about the history of the Elroy Sparta Trail.